cases that change people's lives. The podcast series. You are very welcome to episode one of this series of cases that change people's lives. The first program in the series reviewed the DeBerka case, as it's most commonly known, 1976, which was about the right of women to be automatically appointed to juries, or put the other way, from the perspective of the protagonist at the time, the right of women not to have to be tried by a jury of all men. This episode benefited from observation, commentary, and analysis from leading Irish lawyer and academic, now most recently appointed to the Irish Supreme Court, Mr. Justice Gerard Hogan, and had the benefit of an interview with one of the protagonists in the case, Irish journalist, activist, and writer, Maureen DeBerka.
One way or another, DeBerka was another one of these quite radical decisions from the Supreme Court, which had a profound influence on Irish life.
Hello, and welcome to the first programme in this new series, in which we're going to revisit some cases that have made legal history, and as a consequence changed the lives of many people. Some of these cases are now lost in the mists of time, but they are no less significant for that. You've just heard Gerard Hogan, Senior Counsel from the Law Department in Trinity College, talking about tonight's case, a relatively recent one, DeBerka and the Attorney General. It had to do with how juries were constituted and the Supreme Court decision that was given in 1976. One of the principals in the case was Maureen DeBerka, then a well-known activist, and now a little later I will be talking to her, but firstly I asked Gerard Hogan why this particular case was so important in Irish legal and social history.
The significance of the DeBerka case was that the Supreme Court held two things. First, that confining juries to males and property-owning males at that was unconstitutional. And the court divided as to the reasons. Judge Walsh held that this was contrary to the equality guarantee in the Constitution and that this was gender discrimination of an unjustifiable kind. Judge Henshey, who gave the other principal judgment, said that it was contrary to the guarantee of the right to jury trial in the Constitution because he said that jury presupposed a representative cross-section of the community. But one way or another, DeBerka was another one of these quite radical decisions from the Supreme Court, which had a profound influence on Irish life in the 1970s. It paved the way for a series of decisions, which perhaps are not fully appreciated, which effectively held that most types of gender discrimination are prima facie unconstitutional. Now, the court hasn't always lived up to that particular promise, but DeBerka is one of the groundbreaking decisions of the 1970s.
One of the groundbreaking decisions, as we've heard Gerard Hogan say. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Maureen DeBerka was, along with her friend Mary Anderson, one of the plaintiffs in that case. And when I spoke to her, she began by telling me how she started that momentous journey to the Supreme Court.
It all came about, we were involved in protesting against the Forcible Entry and Occupation Act, which we believed was going to be used against people who were homeless and who squatted in empty property. And they were, as far as I can remember, they were guillotining it in the Dáil. They were cutting short the debate. And we, as members of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, myself and Mary Anderson, were protesting at the gates of the Dáil in Merrion Street. And we were arrested and charged with obstruction or something like that. I can't remember what it was. But on the advice of my solicitor, because I had been involved in other such cases, I opted to go for a trial by jury. I had the choice of either a summary hearing or trial by jury, and he suggested to me that it might be sensible for me at this stage to throw myself on the mercy of a jury. And it's odd to think now, but even though we had been in the women's liberation movement and we knew about the legal sort of inequities that women suffered under, it hadn't really, I suppose, got into our consciousness until then that we were about to be tried by a jury of 12 property-owning men. And we talked about this, myself and Mary, and we agreed that we wanted to do something about this, but neither of us wanted to end up in jail for contempt of court. You know, things like getting up in the middle of the case and sort of walking out and yes. things like that would have, we'd have been sent down for contempt of court. And I had been friendly for a while with Mary Robinson, and I met her one day and I outlined this dilemma to her, and I said, is there a way we can protest about this without ending up in prison? And of course, Mary, being eminently sensible, and of course, the barrister that she was, says, well, there's really only one way, and that's to challenge the constitutionality of the Juries Act of 1927. So she and our solicitors would have taken the case in a hopefully we'll get our expenses basis. This was 1971.
71, you were charged.
71, yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, obviously we had no money between us. Well, Mary might have had a few bob, but I certainly didn't. And we outlined this to her, and, you know, to her credit and to the credit of our other legal team, she said that, I think it was she who said she'd get Donald Barrington on board. And they put together a legal team, which I think was probably one of the best in the country at the time. And Mary was a junior at the time. Donald was the senior and did most of the arguments, and that's how it came about.
How long before you got into the High Court?
I don't think very long. Our case against us for obstruction was put in abeyance until this was heard, so we didn't have to come before a jury in the meantime. Because we were taking the case, I suppose they felt it would be a bit unfair to bring us before a jury when we were challenging the makeup of the jury.
Yes, so that was stayed in the background.
So that was in the background.
I think it was March or April of 73 when you came up on the High Court.
Oh, was it? Well, then yes. It was long enough. It was long enough, because I think the Forcible Entry Bill was about, what, 71, 72?
And I think you came up before Mr Justice Pringle.
Pringle, yes.
How did things go?
Well, you see, a lot of the arguments centred, and I think a lot of legal arguments do centre on the argument that it's sort of a historical fact and why would we change it now kind of thing. They're very keen in legal circles on what has been usage up to this, and very slow to want to change it. And that was a strong argument against changing it.
What was the feeling when you were pursuing it? Did your legal team feel optimistic about it?
I think they did. I think Mary was and she was the one that I was most in contact with. I think she was pretty happy that they would succeed. But we did lose in the High Court.
Yes, there must be a time when you pursue something like that where you begin to wonder why you've started. Did you get
well? I didn't, but
it?
I did feel sorry for my legal team, and I remember saying to Mary when we lost it in the High Court that under no circumstances did we assume that she was going to go into the Supreme Court with it, because she hadn't got any. None of them had got any money up to this, and I said if they wanted to stop it there and then we would understand. We were very happy that they had taken it as far as they had taken it. But if they felt that, you know, they had other things to do and, you know, a living to earn, that we would understand. But yes. They never hesitated. They went straight into the Supreme Court.
From the moment when you were arrested, I think in August of 71, and all of this began, to wait until 73 to get the bad news was quite a long time. Maybe if we just listen for a moment as to the words that you would have heard that day in the court from Mr. Justice Pringle.
Mr. Barrington's second submission was that the exemption of women from liability to serve on juries, save on application in the prescribed form, is inconsistent with Article 40, Section 1 of the Constitution, as being a discrimination on the ground of sex alone, and not on the grounds of capacity, physical or moral, or of social function, and that it did not matter whether this discrimination is against or in favour of women, or against or in favour of men. He said that it was just the same as if the Act of 1927 made all Christians compellable to serve as jurors, but had not made Jews so compellable, save on special application. Finally, I should refer again to Murta Properties v. Cleary, where the plaintiff's first contention was that the objection by the union to the employment of bar waitresses was based not on any suggestion that they were unsuitable for the work, but solely on the ground that they were female, and that this was a breach of the constitutional right of equality before the law, recognised by Article 40 of the Constitution. In dealing with that contention, at pages 334 to 335 of the report, Mr. Justice Kenny said, "This article is not a guarantee that all citizens shall be treated by the law as equal for all purposes, but it means that they shall, as human persons, be held equal before the law. It relates to their essential attributes as persons, those features which make them human beings. It has, in my opinion, nothing to do with their trading activities or with the conditions on which they are employed. See the State Nicolau versus Ambord Uchtola and Quinn's Supermarket v. the Attorney General. Applying the principles laid down in these cases, even if a right to serve as a juror existed, I do not consider that it could be said to be a right relating to the essential attributes of women as human persons, but that it should be regarded rather on the same basis as their trading activities, and so is not within the article. Furthermore, as women are not absolutely debarred from serving as jurors, in my opinion, it cannot be said that there is any invidious discrimination either in favour of or against them. The provision that otherwise qualified women are not bound to serve on juries, unless they wish to do so, seems to me to be a reasonable provision, particularly when regard is had to the provisions of Article 41, Section 2, Subsection 1 of the Constitution, which provides, in particular, the state recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. Having regard to my previous findings, I cannot envisage any manner in which the minister could exercise the powers given to him under the Act of 1927 in such a way as to be unconstitutional. In my opinion, these provisions of Section 2 of the Act of 1927 are not inconsistent with the Constitution. The final submission made by counsel for the plaintiffs was that the provisions of the section under attack were inconsistent with Article 40, Section 3, Subsections 1 of the Constitution because they failed to defend and vindicate the personal rights of the citizen. In dealing with the first submission I have, I think, really dealt with this one too. If, as I consider to be the case, neither the alleged right of the plaintiffs as citizens to serve on a jury, nor their alleged right to be tried by a jury selected at random from all citizens, is a personal right which is protected by Article 40, then it follows that this contention must also fail. In the result, I must refuse to make any of the declarations sought and the action will be dismissed. As the Attorney General asked for them, the plaintiffs must pay his costs.
Oh dear, what did it feel like when you heard those words?
Well, it didn't really affect me because there was no way, I had no property, I had nothing, there was no way he was going to get costs out of me. But we were disappointed, obviously. And I suppose our confidence, the confidence that we had sort of got from our legal team kind of was a bit shaken. But I think to be fair that our legal team more or less said they really hadn't really expected to win it in the first. And that almost certainly they expected it would have to go to the Supreme Court. I don't know whether that was because there would be more judges sitting on it and you'd have a wider point of view,
yes,
represented on the bench or yes, what, I don't know.
Can you recall the picture at the time? What was public opinion? Was there a lot of media interest in the case?
Not a lot, no. Barristers would meet you and say something like, what do you want to... they would say things like, why do you want to sit on a jury? As if we were taking the case solely because we wanted to sit on a jury. I think people didn't quite understand why we were taking the case.
Yes.
Because although the women's movement was, what, 3 or 4 years old at that stage, I don't think it had permeated people's... You know, the real equality in inequities hadn't really got into people's minds. And they were a bit bemused, I think.
Mm. Was there a decision taken quickly to appeal?
I did, as I say, say to Mary that we didn't expect that they would if they didn't want to, but they did straight away.
Did.
I think there's a limit to the time that you have to put in an appeal.
Within which to give notice.
Yes. I don't think they hesitated.
Mm. What was that like then when you went to Supreme Court? Have you a recollection?
I recollect being absolutely awestruck by Donal Barrington's arguments. I didn't see how anyone with half a brain could turn them down. They were so clear, so well thought out, so beautifully argued. And that wasn't just because he was on my side. Mm. If he'd been on the other side, I think I would have been just as admiring him just as well. In fact, I was looking forward to hearing what Tony Hederman was going to say in refutation. I was very disappointed with his... I think he went through the motions, quite frankly. I don't honestly think that he felt that he had a case to answer.
Really?
I mean, I said that wrong. Not that he didn't feel he had a case to answer, but that he didn't have a chance to win. I think he saw the logic of what was being said. It would have been very difficult to listen to Donal Barrington if you were a rational human being and not see the force of his arguments.
Mm. And of course, I think he made five submissions. And I think at that stage, whenever you did go to wait for the judgment, I think that in the descending order, I think the Chief Justice dissented in relation to the sex discrimination submission, because, I mean, the case was fought on five submissions,
right,
and
yes,
relation primarily to the property, the reasonable evaluation criteria.
He was very strong on the, and I remember we had a witness, I think his name was Walsh from, was it the IPA, and he was able to give statistics about difference in racial valuations in different counties, because not only was it based on your property, but in different counties it was based on different racial valuations. So the people who could serve on a jury, men who could serve on a jury, say in Tipperary, because of a certain property thing, couldn't serve in Kildare because the racial valuation was different. So that it was totally unequal, even for men. And of course, the beauty, I suppose, too, of the Supreme Court was that they knew all the objections that were going to be raised because of the judgment in the High Court.
Yes.
So they were able to particularly address those. But he was extremely strong on the property qualification thing, which pleased us because it wasn't just, the disability against women that we wanted. We wanted what eventually happened, which was that people on a jury would be selected at random from the electoral register. That's what we wanted, because that we saw was the fairest. As I say, I remember then at the end, Mary brought up the rear, if you like, and there was a very recent judgment, I think in Florida, which had only just been decided, and she was able to put that before the court.
And do you recall any exchanges? I mean, I know it's a long time ago now, but were there times when you were watching it that you felt, oh, it's going in our favour when their judgments were being read?
Yeah, I did feel that Brian Walsh was on it, and I did feel he was in our favour, because he said at one stage, Mr. Barrington, he said, that means that Wolfe Tone's men of no property will never sit on a jury, or words to that effect. And I thought, yes, that's exactly what it means. But I mean, somebody who said that was hardly going to find against us, at least on the property issue.
Yes, and I think from memory, he also found in relation to the sex discrimination, I think it was only Chief Justice who dissented. There's a very interesting piece where Mr. Justice Walsh gives some of his view in relation to that. We might just hear that now.
Within the terms of Article 40, Section 1 of the Constitution, the reference to social function, as well as the reference to physical and moral capacity, is applicable to both sexes. The evidence in this case indicates that a very small number of those women who are eligible for jury service have volunteered for jury service, or have succeeded in serving when they volunteered. Even assuming that the vast majority of women does not wish to serve on juries in itself, that is not a good ground for legislative discrimination in their favour. From one viewpoint, jury service may be regarded as a privilege, but from another, an exemption from jury service may be regarded as a privilege, just as liberty to avoid any obligation or duty which falls on other people may be regarded as a privilege. The question is whether the privilege is of a type which can be validly conferred by statute. There can be little doubt that the Oireachtas could validly enact statutory provisions which could have due regard within the provisions of Article 40 to differences of capacity, both physical and moral, and of social function, insofar as jury service is concerned. However, the provision made in the Act of 1927 is undisguisedly discriminatory on the ground of sex only. It would not be competent for the Oireachtas to legislate on the basis that women, by reason only of their sex, are physically or morally incapable of serving and acting as jurors. The statutory provision does not seek to make any distinction between the different functions that women may fulfil, and it does not seek to justify the discrimination on the basis of any social function. It simply lumps together half of the members of the adult population, most of whom have only one thing in common, namely their sex. In my view, it is not open to the state to discriminate in its enactments between the persons who are subject to its laws solely upon the ground of the sex of those persons. Clearly, some social function must necessarily depend upon sex, such as motherhood or fatherhood. In the proper context, due recognition may also be given by the law to the fact that certain social functions are more usually performed by one sex rather than by the other. The essential test in each such case is the function and not the sex of the functionary. For these reasons, I am of the opinion that the discrimination contained in the Act of 1927 in favour or against women, depending on one's point of view, is not consistent with the Constitution, and was not carried over as part of the law following the coming into force of the Constitution.
That must have been a great moment.
Yes, he was before his time when you listen to it now, you know, and realise how before his time he was. But what I wanted to say was that there was a catch-22 situation for any woman who, there were some women who felt it was a duty,
yes.
a civic duty, and that they would do it, and they applied. But the catch-22 situation was that these women were seen as, to put it crudely, nutcases. Why would anybody want to sit on a jury if they didn't have to? And they were immediately objected to. And of course they have, I don't know what it is, four or five objections on which they don't have to give any reason.
Yes.
And that is why so few women actually succeeded in getting onto a jury in what, how many years was it? 30, 40 years.
Mm. This is the interesting thing, because it wasn't a ban beforehand. It was a rather obscure. It was that they were exempted from
They were
duty,
exempted.
And they could actually have been on had they applied.
But had they applied and had they been accepted.
And as he points out, they would never. Who's going to voluntarily
do that? I remember a barrister telling me that he would automatically object to anybody who wore a pioneer pin, a fauna, or was a woman.
Yes.
Now, whether that still goes on or not, I don't know, but at least it doesn't affect women. And, one of the things that we were pointing out, and I'm sure Donald Barrington pointed out, was it wasn't just the women's right to sit on juries. It was the woman defendant in the dock's right. And that was where, you know, I think that Brian Walsh was making the point that what you had was perhaps a member of Wolfe Tone's Men of No Property being tried by property-owning men.
Yes, I
and
think
it wasn't a jury of their peers.
No, they touched on this at various times and skirted around it about the assumption that perhaps if you were being tried by somebody who was either a rich man and you were a poor man, or a woman and they were all men, that there would be no inequality or no unfairness, because otherwise, to presume otherwise would be to presume that the jury system didn't work.
Well, I think somebody did raise the thing, if this is agreed and if the 1927 Act is struck down, does that mean that every case that came before the courts with an all-male jury should be struck down as well? And I think somebody did, after we won it, somebody did take a case to say that his conviction was invalid because it was an all-male jury, but it didn't stand
In spite of the fact that I think at least two of the judges in the Supreme Court judgment said that they had covered this point, because retrospectively render them invalid, because those juries at the time that they had been selected had been validly selected. Mm. And it would, and I think Mary Robinson intervened at one point to make that point.
Because she was afraid that this would be a terrible inhibiting factor.
That the grounds of the claim didn't in fact stretch to that. At that point in you were waiting, of course, there was three judges had delivered at that stage. I think Mr. Justice Budd had allowed his to be read out by the Chief Justice. So there just remained Mr. Justice Henchy and Griffin after that. And I suppose there must have been a sense of impending glee, was there, were you?
I remember thinking at a certain stage that we've won it. Like, even if the next person doesn't back us, we've won it anyway. It was an anticlimax to a degree. You've been living with it for 5 years. You know, life had moved on. But when we finally came into the courts on the charge of obstruction, which went back 5 years, they declined to pursue it.
How long after the Supreme Court decision was that?
Not very long afterwards. It was reinstated on the
So you had this hanging over your head.
We had this hanging over our heads, you see. But they struck it out. I suppose there wasn't any point in pursuing it at this stage, and it had been a pretty minor offence anyway, you know.
Well, looking back to that day in 1975 now, the tension is rising, and just towards the end, I think we have Mr. Justice Henchy, who arguably in very simple language sums up.
When a system of jury recruitment is assailed for being exclusionary to the point of unconstitutionality, the test is whether, by intent or operation, there is an exclusion of any class or group of citizens other than those excluded for reasons based on capacity or social function, who, if included, might be expected to carry out their duties as jurors according to beliefs, standards or attitudes not represented by those included. If such a class or group is excluded, it cannot be said that a resulting jury will be representative of the community. The exclusion will leave untapped a reservoir of potential jurors without whom the jurors list will lack constitutional completeness. There is no doubt that a consequence of the exemption of women, unless they claim eligibility, is that women hardly ever serve on juries. Official records show that out of the hundreds of jury trials of criminal offences that took place in this state in the 10 years prior to 1973, and out of the thousands of jurors who served in that period, only two women did jury service. For practical purposes, therefore, jury service is a male preserve, And the plaintiffs are correct in saying that the operation of the statutory exemption of women virtually ensures that the jury before whom they will stand trial will be entirely male. True, the Act of 1927 does not compel this result, but in erecting a rating qualification which in this society rules out most women, and in requiring further that those women not thus excluded should elect for inclusion, the Act of 1927 is the foundation on which the all-male jury rests. If the all-male jury is constitutionally unacceptable, the statutory exemption of women cannot stand. The absence of women from juries means an unconstitutional system of selection for two reasons. First, it fails the test of representativeness, because it means that some 50% of the adult population will never be included in the jury lists. Granted that many of the women who make up the 50% would be entitled to exemption on personal grounds such as pregnancy, nevertheless, the fact remains that a whole swathe of the citizenry, including some 200,000 single women, will be outside the range of choice open to an accused person facing a trial by jury. Secondly, and of even greater importance, that narrowed choice means that a woman's experience, understanding, and general attitude will form no part in the jury processes leading to a verdict. Whatever may have been the position at common law or under statute up to recent times, it is incompatible with the necessary diffusion of rights and duties in a modern democratic society, that important public decisions such as voting or jury verdicts involving life or liberty should be made by male citizens only. The result is that the system of jury selection laid down by the Juries Act 1927, because it is based on a minimum rating qualification and results in the invariable absence of women from juries, is to that extent constitutionally defective, as it does not produce the jury guaranteed by Section 5 of Article 38 of the Constitution. Therefore, I would allow this appeal and declare that the Act of 1927, to the extent that it provides A, that a minimum rating qualification is necessary to make a citizen qualified and liable to serve as a juror, and B, that women are to be exempt from jury service but entitled to serve on application, is inconsistent with the Constitution and is therefore of no force or effect.
That was pretty strong stuff.
Yes, kind of makes you sort of feel a bit proud of them, doesn't it, the judges of the day. I don't know much about the judges today, but that was a real well-thought-out judgment, I thought, from all of them, really.
Have you looked back on those days now and reflected on the significant role that you played in that?
Yeah, I'm glad. I think everybody wants to leave something behind by which they'll be remembered. And I always say to people when, a pretty ineffective life, I always say, well, I'll be remembered as long as there are law students.
Because
I have met law students who say to me, we were doing your case the other day or something like that.
Yes, I didn't mean to leave out Mary Anderson at the beginning, but it is known as DeBurca in the AG. And it has become known.
Yes. Well, we were both arrested, you see, at the demo, and we both took it.
And had you any notion that day, whenever you stood in the way of the guard or whatever it was you did outside the door, that
because we didn't know that our solicitor was going to say, I think we ought to go for a trial by jury.
So you've no regrets?
Oh, none at all. Oh no, it is one of the highlights of my life.
One of the leading cases of our time, and it certainly changed people's lives. Maureen DeBurca, thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.